obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Good morning. My name is Annette, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Desert Powwow, and we hope that you are having a great time. The topic of this morning's meeting is the AA secret. We are pleased to announce today's speaker, Clancy from Venice.
My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I was trying to usher at the same time. There are some seats down here. There are 1, 2, 3 seats down here. 4 seats. 5 seats. 6 seats. Is there anybody here at all? There's a seat. There's a seat. There's a seat back there, about 3 rows. Seat back there. Who cares? Come on time. I'm glad to be here this morning, safe and sane and sober, because I didn't used to be, and I may not be again sometime. That's the nature of the illness. And I was talking to someone about that last night. They wonder how old-timers get drunk. How could you get drunk when you've been sober for 40 years? I know why that is. About 25 years ago, 20 years ago, I was sober 35 years, and I just got sick of AA. I got sick of the whiners and liars and cheaters and just, AA is such a wonderful thing, and yet it's just full of crabs and, shh. Is our starting time inconvenient, miss? I was sober about 35 years. I was sick of AA. And I determined to stop going to meetings for a while. I'd take care of myself and act like an AA member and read the book, but I would not go to meetings. And after about a little over a month, I was feeling tip-top. People dragging me down. But I suddenly realized I was surrounded, the entire world around me was made up of assholes. And I thought, how can that be? And I said, maybe because I didn't go to meetings. I don't know. So I went to a couple of meetings, and they shaped up. But it reminded me, if I hadn't gone to those meetings, if I'd kept fighting it out, I would have gotten to a bad enough place where I wouldn't have had to drink. Because alcoholics, when they get bad enough, go to drink. So it was a good thing. To this day, I don't need AA. I don't go here for me. I go for you. To keep you shaped up. But to discuss AA's secret, it is not much of a secret, actually, but it's a very common secret. We don't know it's a secret. We have to go back a little bit in time. Most of us, we've got a lot of new people here, know that in 1930, a very wealthy family in New York was concerned about their son, they were grooming to take over their big company, and he had periods of getting nervousness and getting drunk. And they found the best doctor in the world to send him to, Dr. Freud. And Dr. Freud refused to take the case, which was the only break we ever got up till then. Otherwise, we'd all be sitting here drunk today and saying, I dreamt I was sober. So he went to see his colleague, Dr. Young, and Dr. Young put him in his hospital. I visited that hospital last January, not much of a hospital. And they put him in the hospital and worked with him for a year or just about. And then said, Roland, I think you're okay. And he said, Roland, home. And Roland got as far as Paris, had a big dinner in his honor for some wealthy friends of his family. And, he got drunk and stayed drunk, and they had to send him back to the hospital, and Dr. Jung wouldn't take him back. And he said, well, Roland didn't mean any harm. He just seemed to get an attack of nervousness or something. He said, Bob, there's a seat up here. Do you care? All right, well, leave me alone. And, I mean, he's the head of the Valley Central Office. Someday I may get down on my luck and move to the Valley. I'll tell you a little story. I don't know if in your rooms they have a book about the Beatles. I mean about the Rat Pack. They have a book about the Rat Pack put together by Life magazine. I was looking at that and remember the interview that Sammy Davis Jr. had. They said to him, how are you doing, Sammy? He said, I'm very grateful. He said, that's odd. Grateful? You've lost an eye in an auto accident. Your health has been terrible. You married a white girl, caused a great deal of stress on your from both races. He said, what are you grateful for? He said, well, I never had to move to the Valley. That's what he said. I didn't say it. Yeah. But anyway, they brought him back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung said, I won't take him back. And they said, why not? He said, because I realize now I misdiagnosed his case. I thought he had psychiatric problems I could help him with. I now realize that he is what's called a chronic alcoholic, and there's no treatment for that condition in the world today at any price. Can you imagine that? That's 1931, not all that long ago. And so Roland said, what does this mean? He said, what it means, Roland, is that you must keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live. Otherwise, you almost certainly will intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. Bad news in the morning. And he said, is there no other alternative whatsoever? He said, well, he said, I've seen in the literature some intensive involuntary psychological change, which they call a spiritual experience, but I've never seen one, and I've never known anyone who's ever seen one. They're very rare. He said, your chances of being hit by lightning are better than getting an involuntary spiritual experience. So he came home and he felt terribly depressed. It's always been an amazement to me why people in AA have some sort of reverence for Dr. Jung. All he did was tell us nothing works and sent this poor bastard home. And he was terribly depressed. He almost committed suicide when he got back. He was so hopeless. And then someone told him about something. He said, have you tried the Oxford group? That's a new thing. And he didn't know what that was. And that was kind of an interesting arrangement. In 1908, a Lutheran minister in Pennsylvania thought Christians were getting too loose. They weren't as dedicated as they used to be. They'd be willing to used to die for their faith, to be crucified. Now you couldn't even go to church when it was raining. So he started an organization called the First Century Christian Association, and help people get dedicated. He didn't get many people, you know, to come. I don't think I want to be crucified this month, doctor. And he didn't get many members, but after the First World War, he went to Europe and tried to talk it up in England and France and Germany, and didn't get much reaction except one place in Oxford University. For some reason, the students there just thought it was wonderful, just what we need to remind us to be intense. And so when the Oxford group changed his name from the First Century Christian Association in usage to the Oxford group, he brought it back to the United States in 1930 or thereabouts. And it had a different form now. It wasn't that intensity. It really wound up, as it turned out, to well-to-do, better-type people in every community getting together in one another's homes and discussing how they could enhance their spiritual values. And but it seemed to had a good reputation. So someone recommended to Roland, and Roland said, geez, that doesn't sound like much. But he went over there to talk to him and was taken by it and got involved in it and just gung-ho. And for 3 years, he stayed sober, became president of his family's company, and stayed sober. And finally, his family said, you're working so hard, Roland, and you haven't taken a vacation. Why don't you go this summer, take a couple weeks to go up to our home in our child home up in Vermont, where we used to take you when you were a little boy, and just take a couple weeks off and go up there and relax. He said, okay. So he went up there, and the miracle of AA is this. If he'd have gone 2 weeks sooner, we wouldn't be here. If he'd have gone 2 weeks later, we wouldn't be here. It had to be just that window, because once he got there, somebody always said, you know, remember that kid we used to play with, that little Ebby? He's a bad drunk. Now, I understand you used to drink too, but you stopped. And could you talk to Ebby? He said, sure, bring him over. He tried to tell me a little bit about the Oxford group. He said, well, Ebby, really you got to just start with the concept that there's a power greater than yourself. And Ebby said, I don't want to hear that religious crap. And went and got drunk. And the next day they came back and said, oh, maybe you could help us again. I'm so sorry. But Ebby got drunk last night and ran his car into somebody's house. And he's been on probation, and they're going to send him to the penitentiary this morning in court. And he said, my father's the judge. He won't listen to me. But maybe he'll listen to you because he knows your father so well. So Ebby appeared in court. Roland appeared in court since he happened to be in town. Said, you know, Judge, I understand Ebby a little bit because I used to be the same way, and now I don't drink anymore due to the Oxford group. And if you'd release him to my custody, I'll take him to New York and put him in the Oxford group to see what happens. The judge said, only because it's you, Roland, I would do this for no one else. I'll do it for you because you happen to be here. So I took him down. He says, if he ever comes back to Vermont, he's going to the penitentiary. So we took him down to New York and put him in the Oxford group. And Ebby wasn't really crazy about it, but it's better than being in the stir up in New Jersey or Vermont or where the hell it was. And he got involved and got excited about it. He stayed sober and got little jobs. And one day Roland came by and said, well, Ebby, it's time to testify. He said, testify? What the hell does that mean? He said, I'm surprised you haven't heard about it. When we do a good job here for a while, then we go out and testify to people and tell them what we found. And Ebby said, I don't want to do that. That's embarrassing. He said, you want to go back to Vermont? He said, I believe I'll testify. And so he thought, who could I testify to that wouldn't be taken aback by it? I remember another friend of his from abroad. He was a kid who had come to New York, became a big shot, and was now a drunk, had lost everything. This guy, Bill Wilson, I bet I could talk to him, and he wouldn't even remember it the next day. So he found Bill Wilson and went over there to make arrangements to see him in our book. Bill says, Ebby came over, clean cut, sharp. And Ebby said the bad word when he came in. He said, Bill said, how do you get, what are you doing, Ebby? He said, I've got religion. That ended Bill's interest in the conversation. Oh. So they sat down at the kitchen table, and Ebby talked about the Oxford group, and Bill drank as fast as he could. That's really good, Ebby. I bet that's really helping you. And Ebby left. He felt a little sour and wasted his time, but at least he had that step out of the way. And that was the end of it. In about November of the same year, Bill was thinking one day, which is, as has been said, not our best attitude, and thought, you know, I was really rotten to Ebby. He meant well, a poor dumb bastard, but he meant well, but I'm not interested in his religious experiences, but I should tell him I appreciate what he did. So he found where Ebby was. Ebby had told him, given him an address in Manhattan on Lower Broadway, a mission, and he went over there and one November morning, got drunk on the way just to build up his strength. Got there and Ebby was gone. So he gave a short sermon to the folks there just to show them what's going on. Staggered on down the street. That next night he was back in the hospital again where he always went when he couldn't function anymore. His brother-in-law had some juice with the hospital. He had no money for it. And in bad shape. In fact, the doctor called his wife and said, Mrs. Wilson, I'm very sorry, but this is your husband's probably last trip to this hospital because he'll never survive another one of these drunks he's on. He can't survive it. He's too far gone. And she was panicking. She called the mission and said, Ebby, get up there. Bill may be dying. So he got some guys went up there, and And he said the magic words that had been said to him, Roland had said to him, he said, Bill, you got to start off by finding, believing there's a power greater than yourself. But I don't want to hear that crap. So they went home. And Bill, this old ne'er-do-well, ex-stockbroker, big shot now, bum on the street, living off his wife, pitching and tossing in the bed. At midnight, he suddenly woke up. And if there's a God, show yourself! And all of a sudden, the lights in the room went on like somebody throwed a switch. Nobody throwed a switch. My God, what could this be? And a wind came through closed windows. How can that? That can't be. He knew he was going insane, is what he knew. And he thought, I'm having a psychiatric breakdown. But he felt good, oddly enough. And he told the doctor about it the next morning. The doctor said, he said, did I have a psychiatric breakdown, Doc? So we looked at him and said, no, Bill, I don't think so. I don't know what it is, but you look different somehow. Whatever happened to you last night, hang on to it. And so he turned out this unworthy person seemed to have a spiritual experience. And he came out of there and he associated with the Oxford group because Abby was in the Oxford group. So he started going to the Oxford group and he convinced himself that he'd been given a mandate by God to help drunkards. And he went to the Oxford group every day. And he would pick up a street drunk on the way. And bring him into this group of nice people. I believe you're vomiting on my shoes, sir. And sometimes you take him home when they had no place to go. A guy committed suicide in his house one day while he was gone. And not one person ever stayed sober. And he gave it all he had. For 6 months, this went on. And finally, he got up one morning, and he saw his wife, who had been a chic debutante when he met her, who was now kind of old before her time with salt and pepper hair and kind of blousy and putting on her old clothes with a sweater with a sleeve and a patch on the sleeve to go to work in this cheap department store where she had a job as a clerk in the Depression. So at least they could pay the rent so he could go help drunkards. And he had a terrible feeling of remorse. He said, Lois, I'm sorry, darling. I'm so sorry to see you go off to work like this again. He said, I'm going to quit this crap I'm doing. I'm going to get a job tomorrow for just shoveling dirt somewhere. I'm going to get a job and get you out of that department store. He said, I've tried everything I know, and not one person has stayed sober. And right there, your life and mine hung by a thread about that big. The movement was almost over. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I was having lunch with her about 40 years ago up in Connecticut. And I asked her about that. I said, Lois, how did you ever think that great answer you gave us saved our lives? She said, I don't know. It seems so obvious. He said, not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. Oh, yeah. That's why old-timers don't have much hair in front. You just, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And so, but he knew he was doing something wrong. And he went down to the doctor at the hospital where he was well-known and said, Doc, I've been trying to help these people since I was here, and not one person stayed sober. The doctor said, what are you trying to tell them? He said, I'm trying to teach them to have a spiritual experience. He says, that's ridiculous. That can't happen. It can't happen. So it's not a conscious reaction. He said, you're making a big mistake, you know. And he went into a little detail with them. They're not covered in our book, but he said, alcoholics are odd people. We have no answer for them here. I have no answer for you. Stop and think. You guys come in here every month or two, so sick you can't walk, and we get you in shape, and you promise not to drink again, and we release you, and you're back here in 2 months drunk again. We have no answer for you. Nobody has any answer for you. He said, But it's almost as though drunkards are like, or alcoholics are like, people who live in invisible shields, clear plastic. You can see them and you can talk to them, but whatever you say just bounces off. Boom, boom. I think you ought to try this. Thanks. Boom, boom, boom. Thank you very much. That's a good idea. Boom, boom. Nobody ever gets through. He says, you can't get through to these guys. You're such a tragic bunch. I always had the feeling, he said, that to get through that, since nobody knows how to get through that wall, and it's called, but you don't understand, my case is different. He said, to get through that wall, which is impervious to any kind of advice, you could somehow say to the guy, you know, I'm a drunkard myself, and I've had a lot of problems too. And Bill said, oh, that would be a terrible thing to tell him, I think. He said, no. He said, try. I've always thought it'd be a good idea. I can't tell him because I'm not an alcoholic. I don't know what it feels, what your sensations are. I hear you talk about how wonderful you feel when you drink and how terrible you feel when you try to quit. And I don't understand that at all. It just seems to me you should quit. But if you could talk to him that way and get some identification, maybe they would open up a little bit and let some of that stuff through. Bill said, I don't think it's going to work at all. That's a bad idea, Doc, but thanks. And he went home. And shortly after, he got a letter from a friend, some people on Wall Street, who said, you know, Bill, we hear through the grapevine that you've been not drinking for a few months, and we got a chance for you to prove yourself. We got a deal going in Akron, Ohio, where we're going to take over this machine tool company, rubber machine tool company. He said, we need someone to go out there and pick up the proxies. And you could do that because you know exactly what's going on. And if you can do that, you will make you president of that company and you'll be on Easy Street. And would you go out there and do it? Bill said, oh, God, yes. He was afraid, but he decided to do it. And he went out there and got to work on it, and the whole deal blew up. Not his fault. Some other guy had blown. And he stood in the lobby of the hotel in Akron on May of 1935. I remember I stood there in May of 1971 or something, trying to recreate the feeling. I couldn't, but I can imagine what he felt like. He reached in his pocket. He had $10. He could either pay his hotel bill or buy a train ticket home. He hated to go home and admit failure because he told everybody about this deal, and his wife was so excited about it. And he had to come, no, I failed again. Sorry. Couldn't bear to do it. I'm sure that everybody in this room has had that feeling one time or another, having to report back that you didn't do it this time like you promised. I think one of the classic lines I know of AA is someone you love looking at you and saying, how could you? You promised. You were doing better. And we were starting to get along well together, and the kids were fine, and your job was going better. And now you're drunk again. How could you do such a thing? I can't understand it. How could you do it? We've all heard that one. And you know what the correct answer is? Leave me alone. Stop nagging me, God damn it. And it's funny now, but it isn't funny then, I'll tell you. I had kind of an experience last December that reminded me of that. My wife has passed away, but I need other reminders. And in the middle of the night, I was sleeping, and my dog started barking in the living room. I got a mess of dogs. My daughters bring them. Woof, woof, woof. Shut up in there! Try to sleep! I said spiritually. And they didn't understand. So I walked in the living room, and through the big living room window, there was a guy sitting on a little wall, which is on our sidewalk. Out in front, there's a little wall next to it, slumped over. Up there, I said, what the hell are you doing out there? He said, going to a lecture. I said, going to a lecture? About what? About alcoholism. I said, don't give me that. I'm big in alcoholism. I don't have any lectures in Venice at 2 o'clock in the morning. Where are you going to a lecture?
At my house.
I said, God bless you, pal, and I shut the door and went back to bed. Because I know where it goes from there.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
But he didn't know what to do, and he writes that he was standing in this lobby. And I stood in that lobby. At that time, his husband turned to a senior, later turned into a senior citizen's home, which I may wind up there. But anyway, over there there's a door, was a door with a curved sign over it in orange neon saying cocktails. And he said, out of that door was coming the sound of clinking glasses and laughter. And he had a feeling that I'm sure you and I would have. I'd have it, I think. If I just had a couple drinks, I could think of the answer to this problem, what to do. And so he started. And every step he took, your life and mine diminished. And he, out of the corner of his eye, he saw across on the far wall some payphones. To you young folks, there used to be black phones on the wall. And you didn't have to go. You know. And he remembered he'd promised his friends in New York in the Oxford group that he would call somebody before he did anything drastic. So he went over there, and in small town hotels then, and I guess maybe now for all I know, they have a little sign over the bank of phones, at least the leading churches and the ministers and their phone numbers. And so he went to called the first number. He said, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hound from New York. I need to talk to somebody in the Oxford group. And the man said, I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me again. Hung up. That might have been just about enough for me, but maybe not. He called the next number. He got a busy signal. Next number got a busy signal. Called the next number. Man said, I wish I could help you. I've heard of the Oxford group, but we don't do it in our church, but I wish you well. I don't know anyone. At least he was kind. He said, well, a couple drinks doesn't sound bad. He started to walk away. Out of the corner of his eye, saw the last name on the wall. The only guy he hadn't called, Walter Tunk. He said, Jesus, I really want to be rejected by Walter Tunk before I go anywhere. So he called Walter Tunk, who turned out to be the only person in Akron who could have helped him at that moment. Now, that's another miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Walter Tunk said, funny you should call. I was just talking to a wealthy parishioner of mine who was telling me about their Oxford group meeting this week, that their doctor in their Oxford group admitted he was a drunkard and he couldn't help himself. And they've all been praying for him incessantly since, but he's still drunk. He said, maybe I could put you in touch with him somehow. Let me call. You stay in the phone booth. So he called the parishioner in West Akron, in the big mansion, rubber company mansion, and he told her the story. She said, yes, I'd like to have him talk to my doctor. Something might happen. So let me call his home and get. So she called Mrs. Smith, who called the Smith residence, and it rang and rang and rang, and nobody answered. And just as she's hanging up, she heard a voice say, hello, oh, I'm sorry, I was out in the yard. And she identified what she was. She said, there's a person we think we might be able to help your husband. She said, well, I'd like to have him talk to him, but he's drunk under the coffee table now. I probably couldn't talk to him very much, but I believe I can sober him up by tomorrow. She said, all right, bring him out to my house in West Akron, and I'll get this man from New York out there. Perhaps they could talk. So she called.
she called the doctor. The minister had given her Bill's number, so she called Bill and told him how to get a streetcar out to her house. And the next day, they went out and gathered there. In 1980, at the International Convention, one of the highlights of the meeting that Johnny Harris spoke at was at, I mean, the other highlights. Was that at the end of the meeting, they said, we have a distinguished guest here today, and nobody had ever heard of him. We have Dr. Bob's son, Bob Smith. This guy came out, young guy, not young, but 35, 40. Everybody, geez, we, oh, didn't even know he had a son, you know, hey. And he, it broke our heart to discover he was in Al-Anon. No, it really didn't. I mean, it really did. But he was married to a drunken woman, and he got active in Al-Anon that year. And he started talking at conventions all over the country. He and I got to be pretty good friends. And he would talk about, and one of the highlights of his talk was the trip out to that house. Because his father was too sick to drive, too hungover to drive. So he and his sister sat in the front seat, and his mother and father sat in the back seat, and all the way up to his father said, you know, Ann, I'll talk to this man. I just hate it, but I'll talk to him because it's Mother's Day today, and I ruined Mother's Day for you with my damn drinking. And I don't mean to drink, and you know that, but I'm sorry, but I'll give the guy 10 minutes. I'll give him 10 minutes, honey, and I hope you'll understand. I just can't stand anymore. I just can't stand anymore. And they got out there, and they had a little bite to eat. Then they had to join to an adjoining room where to do their 10 minutes. And we're in there for 4 hours. And they came out, and Dr. Bob staggered over his wife, not staggered from drinking, but from amazement. He said, Ann, that man is the first man that ever seems to know how I feel. And when I drink, how I feel. And what happens to me when I try to quit. He said, I can't believe it. I thought I was the only one in the world. My God. He said, Bill, I know you have to get back to New York, but could you stay with us a couple of weeks and maybe just chat a little bit more? And Bill thought, let's see. I can't afford to get out of town. Yes, I can stay here. So for 2 weeks, they sat and talked about religion and spirituality, and Dr. Bob just blossomed. And Bill talked to him about the higher power and what you could find. It's just wonderful. And one day the doctor said to Bill, Bill, you know, I'm feeling so much different. I wasn't even going to do that this year. But this year I want to go to Atlantic City this weekend for the American Medical Association meeting, National Medical Association meeting. So I was there last year, and I was so drunk, and they all ridiculed me and kicked at me, some of them. He said, would you stay here with my wife and two kids, my son and daughter, while I go to New York, and I'll be back Tuesday morning? And Bill said, you bet. Good, go get him, Bob. And Bob went off to Atlantic City. Tuesday morning early, the phone rang. Woman on the phone saying, Mrs. Smith, I am so sorry. This is the doctor's office nurse. He got off the train so bad this morning, so drunk he couldn't walk. They had to carry him off the train. And the station agent knew that I worked for him, so he called me, and I came down, and the cab driver and I have got him on the floor of his office, and he's crying. He's so sorry. And I'm so sorry, because he was doing so well. He was doing so well. It's such a great experiment, and it didn't work. So that's almost the end of our lives right there. Mrs. Smith said, okay, Mr. Wilson and I will be down to pick him up. Came down to pick him up. Rode him home. I'm so sorry. I have over the years worked with a lot of drunks. I would try to avoid a sorry, crying drunk. God, they're sickening. I'm sorry. Now you're sorry, you son of a bitch. Right? But they got him home and put him to bed and bathed him and put him to bed. And Thursday morning he sat up. He said, what day is it? Thursday morning, Bob. He said, Oh my God, I've got to do a cancer surgery this morning. I've got to do a cancer, and I can't hold a knife. Look at my hand. They'll take my license. I got no chance. What can I do? So Bill and his wife got him up and bathed him and dressed him. And his new friend Bill went down and got him some beer to steady his hand. He went off to the hospital and said, I'll be home about 2 o'clock. Went to the hospital. 2 o'clock came, he didn't come back. 3 o'clock, didn't come back. 4 o'clock, didn't come back. 5 o'clock, didn't come back. That son of a bitch is drunk again. At 6 o'clock, he came through the door, cold sober, said, I'm home. Where have you been, Bob? We've been worried sick about you. He said, when I was doing that surgery, remember in Oxford Group, we've been talking about making amends. And I didn't ever thought a doctor would have to make amends. But I'm a human being more than I'm a doctor. And I've made some mistakes. And I've been all over Akron today making amends to people. And I feel wonderful. And that's what they call the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous, June 10th, 1935. They didn't know it was the birthday of anything, just two more losers getting together. Should we have a cake? No, not yet. But the one thing that came out of that experience, they realized that sitting and talking about spirituality is not the answer. It's a help, but it's not the answer. And God, Dr. Bob didn't keep him from getting drunk. And Bill thought over his, yeah. And all the years, he was, all those months ago, those people, he didn't sit and talk to them about spirituality. He tried to get them to a meeting, an Oxford Group meeting, but a meeting. He said, you know, what do we have to do? Apparently, we have to try to help people. We have to try to, we can't just get wonderful. We have to help people. And the doctor said, yes. You know, in our hospital here, or any hospital at that time for that matter, drunks could not get in. There's no waiting in for you. You could be dying of alcoholic liver. They wouldn't care. But you had to have something wrong with you, something physically wrong they could identify to write up. And so in our hospital here, we sometimes get people who are secondary drunks, but primarily some other illness. And I'll call up there. There's a nun that just was a great friend of mine always. He called up and said, hello, Sister Ignatia. He said, do you have any drunks up there? She said, yes, we do. We have a lawyer here for a gastrointestinal problem, but he is really a bad drunk, and he's having a terrible time. She said, do you think we could talk to him? She said, I'll check with his wife. You know, in 1960, I was kind of new, really new, and I went to the International Convention, and I heard Sister Ignatia tell that story about herself. God, that was touching. And I went up afterwards, and thank you, Lai, and I was just swept away because I'd been slipping for 10 years, and I was finally sober for 3 months. I'm on my way now, and I thank Sister Ignatia, and I gave her a kiss on the cheek. I think I had a feeling, maybe you're not supposed to kiss nuns, I don't know. I'm a Lutheran, what do I know? And I think I said, is it all right to kiss a nun, Sister Ignatia? And I think she said, as long as you don't get in the habit. It's a long time ago. I can't remember every detail from 1960, for God's sake. But she got a hold of the man's wife, who's a rather strong woman, apparently. I heard him talk, the patient talk, some years later in the meeting. He said, I was laying in that bed in Akron, Ohio. I was despondent. Nothing could help me. And my wife came in and said, two men want to talk to me about drinking. And I said, absolutely not. I'm so sick of getting lectures about my drinking. It does not help. It just makes me feel bad. I can't hold my food down after I get one of those lectures. No, don't ask me again. No. But he said, my wife's a rather strong woman. So I saw those two guys. And they never talked about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt, and how drinking made them feel, and how stopping drinking made them feel. And I was flabbergasted. I thought for sure I was the only man in the world who had that feeling. And I couldn't believe my ears. My God. And I stuck with those fellas, and I've been with them ever since. And he was number three. Then they had a hard time getting people, because you had to take them to the Oxford group. There was no meetings of AA, just Oxford group. You hit on them about Jesus for an hour, and then,
oh, Christ out here.
And so there's a difficult time. They're teaching them, had to teach them. But they're trying to talk to them to make them feel I understand, then take them to a church meeting where they didn't care how you felt. They didn't get very many, but they got a young guy, one young guy, kind of this side, this kind of, and his name was Ernie, and he was 29. He said, Ernie, you can't be an alcoholic that young, but you drink like one. You can come with us. And so they went around, and young Ernie, as he got acquainted with them, and they got to know both of them well, fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter. He had a daughter and a son. He fell in love with Bob's daughter and brought us, although they didn't know it at the time, brought our organization its first emotional alignment, our first romance, our first relationship. I don't know a word that more scares me on the telephone than to hear some goof, new goof say, I think I found the girl of my dreams. Oh. Well, how about the last one? I liked her too, but when I saw Margaret walking out of detox today, I just knew. What you need then is a phone, and just put it down on the answering machine and go away and do your business. You know? Stupid is what it is. But he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter, Tender, and they kind of poo-pooed it for a while, but they're deeply in love. And they got married. Perfect end to a relationship. That happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susan, who's now an excellent AA, by the way, but she married a guy I sponsored who was a boob of the first water. 5 years sober, rotten ex-con, rotten son of a bitch is what he was. And still is. But they got married because my daughters, I have a family of daughters, all who know much more than I do about anything. Oh, you don't know what you're talking about, Daddy. I will tell you. And I'll give you the, as I've said many times, the perfect epitome of mixed emotions. It's watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. Hold it! But you just have to grin and bear it. That's what we in AA do. And Ernie, so they told Ernie, you don't have to go to meetings anymore. You don't have to help us people. Just stay home, take care of your wife to be a good husband and good father, hopefully soon. And Ernie got drunk. They had no idea that stopping doing what he was doing would get him drunk. And he didn't get sober again for 50 years. And 50 years later, he finally wound up with 1 year sobriety. And turned her against AA for 50 years. She just hated AA, wondering why her father was in it. But that's what happened. They finally got some few people together. But in that period of time, they discovered the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's a lot of organizations out there. You read ads about them in the paper, in the magazines. We'll help you stay sober. You don't have to go to those meetings. Take those. We're not an AAO-based organization. We're not 12-step based. And they will tell you that they don't have to. And they have some great speakers who really can identify and do these things. But they don't have any results. They come out feeling wonderful, and shortly thereafter they seem to be taken drunk. See the movie stars one by one come out of promises, and a month later they're in another traffic jam somewhere or something. And why is that? Because of AA's, the thing that transfers AA from a movement into a life-saving operation. And the secret is such a silly secret. Identification. Identification. You can tell me all day long what to do, and if I don't have confidence in you, I don't care what you say. I'll just nod and do my own. But if I believe that you know how I feel and really care for me, that I'm doing something, then I'm liable to do it if I'm desperate. And that's what happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. When they begin talking to people about their emotions, not their drinking, when they begin talking to them, I know how you feel, and it changed the course of history. And we began to be an organization. And Bill went back to New York with this radical new approach, got a few people sober, got them out talking it up, and pretty soon they start doing well. 3 years, 1938, they were doing well enough so that they wanted to write a book so they could raise enough money to build an alcoholic hospital so drunks would have some place to go and not die. And they wrote the book, but it didn't, the book we use today, but it didn't sell at all, so they didn't build any hospital. But saved our lives. What do we care? And I mean, as the old mark of AA, the basic AA sympathy remark, better you than me. And they grew, and now 1946, they went to Europe, to Ireland and England. Then little by little filtered around. I was speaking in Germany a few years ago, and a little group of German A's from all over, they had their meeting in German. I talked to them in English. I'm sure I made a wonderful impression. Was ist los? Yeah. But I had a woman who interpreted for me. I learned my first sentence. The first sentence was, Mein Name ist Clancy und ich bin ein Alkoholiker. The old son of a bitch is going to talk to us in German. Good. But that was the end of that. This woman would interpret for me just talking. It actually got to be pretty good. You got to develop a rhythm. I'd talk and she'd talk and I'd talk. The other thing that hurt me, I'd say something really clever. They'd all sit there. And then she'd say, they'd go, ha, 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 ha. That was me who said that, not her. But I've had the opportunity over the years to go to some exotic places in Thailand and South America and all over a lot of places. I've been on all the continents except South Pole. Hope to get down there someday and work with the problems in the birds. But it's the same thing all over the world. It's hard for us to remember that. We want to talk about so many things and read you the steps. It's all very interesting. But first you have to get the hook in somehow. You have to convince people you know how they feel. That's the mark of the 12-step call. That's the mark of a meeting. Because, you know, meetings were originally formed so they could bring new people and show there were other people sober. But, of course, they become something else again. They become a social event, become a refreshment event, so on. But that's why when you talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, you want to tell your story a little bit, even though you've heard it too many times. You may have talked about other things too, but you've got to talk about your story. And it's dull talking about alcoholism when you've talked about it for 50 years. But that's what's going to get through. Alcoholism is going to get through. When I think the greatest thing I ever learned, my sponsor told me once in passing on a cold night when I hated him, I was going to get drunk anyway. And he said something to me that I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. And he said something that made me believe I was an alcoholic from then to now. I said, but I'm not really an alcoholic. Those guys are much worse than I am. He said, kid, alcoholics aren't people whose problem is alcohol. Alcoholics are people whose answer is alcohol. If it's your answer, you're screwed. Because that's true. And that's what we'll have for the rest of our life. Not the fact that alcohol doesn't bother me at all. But there have been times, sometime not lately, but there have been times when it looked awfully good because I was in a jam or a problem or I couldn't solve. And like Bill Wilson in that hotel lobby. Just, but I know there's people I can call and talk to who will say, yes, I understand that. And I've had that feeling. And I know how it goes. So it's kind of an interesting thing that the big secret of alcoholics that makes Alcoholics Anonymous work is just identification. We all know about it. So what? But that is what transforms us from all the other organizations where they have much better speakers, much better teachers, much better programs, and even now drugs to take away the craving. You hear that ad? I mean, I just said that'd be funny. I would take. But I asked, what do you think about that? Take away the craving for a drink. But what does it just leave you? Just leave you feeling crappy without any exit at all. So I think we're very fortunate. Because I go all over the world and I hear people talk about the same emotions and same feelings that Dr. Bob thought were unique unto him. And Bill D. thought was unique unto him. And Bill Wilson thought was unique unto him. And we all thought was unique unto us in our little invisible shield. But you don't understand. I'm not really an alcoholic. My problem is I'm too sensitive. I feel things too intensely. My case is different. That's the universal cry of all of us, it seems like. So I'm very glad to be here this morning. I thought that would be a good topic. Shirley said, what do you mean, the AA secret? What's that? I said, well, come to the meeting and find out. Now, that might not have happened, but it seemed to me it did. So I'm very happy to be here, and I hope we all have a splendid weekend. Thank you.
You've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.